Good afternoon. Welcome to the first episode of the new IDC podcast series. We've had a bit of a hiatus as of late, but we are back, and we're so excited to be getting this new series underway. The first episode is actually titled Taking Stock of Creating an Inclusive Culture Within Organizations. We're very fortunate to have two really great speakers with us today. We've got Camilla Bruggen, and we've also got Dr. Maria Adamson. And I'm going to ask both of them to say a few words about themselves. I will start first with Camilla Bruggen. So if you'd like to just introduce yourself to the audience, please.
Thank you, Lloyd. So yeah, I'm Camilla Bruggen. I'm the Global Head of Diversity, Equity and Inclusion at Wavemaker, which is a multinational media agency, part of the wider WPP Marcoms Communications Group. My role, so I'm the Global Head of Diversity, Equity and Inclusion. I'm in the Global People team, reporting into our Chief People Officer. And my role is about developing and then rolling out diversity, equity and inclusion strategy for Wavemaker's 7,000 employees based all over the world. So working with leaders as well as our DE&I champions to embed an inclusive culture and ensure that people at Wavemaker feel that they can belong, be their authentic selves and do their kind of best work.
Great. Thanks for that, Camilla. Maria, would you like to say a few words about yourself?
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me. My name is Maria Adamson, and I'm an Associate Professor of Organisation Studies at Queen Mary University of London. I am also a co-director of CRED, which is a Centre for Research on Equality and Diversity. And I've been researching equality and diversity for quite a while now, and my focus is gender and professional work mainly, but I've looked at issues of inclusion, intersectionality, role modeling, and my current project has been on flexible work and COVID.
Wow, okay. So that's pretty amazing range of experiences and backgrounds that you both come from, and so I kind of want to sort of get straight into the questions, and really the first one, which I'm going to kind of direct to Camilla. So obviously, as you've already explained, you have a global role in DEI at Wavemaker at the moment. But I know that previously you were head of data insight at Wavemaker as well. And you've had quite a long sort of journey at Wavemaker over the years. And so I guess really, what I wanted to understand was, what was the transition like for you, sort of moving over from data insight into DEI? And what was the learning journey like, particularly in those sort of early stages when you were obviously getting to grips with the role?
Thanks, Lloyd. Yeah, so my career before I moved into DE&I was starting off in market research, then moving into account planning at advertising agencies, then communications planning and consumer insight, data insight and media agencies. So it's been always in the research and data side and strategy side of the business, which I have enjoyed, and I love doing research, and I love kind of consumer behavior and people behavior, what makes people tick, what influences people's behavior and around behavior change. So I'd always done that area of work for brands, and also I had kind of really enjoyed my academic studies. If I did a psychology degree, and then I did an organizational and occupational master's after my degree, and I actually went back to a UCL in 2013 and did an MSc in health psychology, because that's another area that I'm very interested in, kind of health and well-being. But I decided to not move into that area. So I stayed, sorry, Lloyd, I'm totally waffling, so I'll try and be a bit more concise. You obviously edit
that's
that
fine. Now. No, but this is good.
So working in the data insight team was really great, but I'd been a Wavemaker a long time. And as I was getting older as well, one of the things I realized looking around me was kind of, where have all the amazing women that I started my career with, where have they all gone? And whereas a lot of the men I knew were doing incredibly well, the women seemed to have disappeared. And I wondered where they'd gone. A lot had children and didn't come back, or various things happened and they left the business and left the industry. And when at that point in around 2018, when I looked at our leaders, especially in the UK, they were nearly all men. And it made me think a lot about gender equality and what Wavemaker was doing and what we could do better around gender equality. So with a colleague, I set up Women at Wavemaker, which was all about the gender equality piece and supporting women throughout their careers, running inspirational sessions, but also mentoring and training. Started doing that and quickly realized it was a lot more than just gender. It was about intersectionality and, you know, understanding privilege of different groups and how you can really make people feel included. So I had my psychology background plus my job in research. So I started looking into the kind of data and evidence, a lot of social science around this area, and feeling kind of more and more passionate about it. So went to the chief people officer and said, let me use some of my research and data and strategy skills to start looking at what is the data we have about our business, what evidence is out there around behavioral change programs that we can use to bring into the business to improve the experience of marginalized groups in the people in the organization, stop people leaving, and really make the culture more inclusive. So that was my journey, and I started doing that one day a week, because at that time I was working part-time. Then I moved to doing it 2 days a week, and then this year I moved to doing the role full-time. So the transition was over a couple of years. It was really exciting learning about a new area and looking at the evidence and the data that is out there. It was also terribly difficult trying to juggle two roles. You know, it felt very hard. I was torn, like I was working with clients on one side of my data insight role and they always have to come first. But my huge passion was around diversity, equity and inclusion. So it was tough to balance the two roles. But it was something I was so passionate about, it was also really interesting and fascinating to learn about the area and come up to speed and like absorb all of that information. And I've done a lot of talking with people at Wavemaker as well as other organizations to kind of understand what is the experience of different groups.
Sure. No, that's really great. And I think, you know, something that you've kind of mentioned there is how actually, you know, the skills that you've developed from other roles were actually really transferable into the DEI space, and has probably actually served you in good stead in some respects.
I think so. I think, first of all, the skills, like the research, analysis skills, strategy skills, but also the insights of being in the business and working at the coalface. So actually having the demands of that job, working with clients, understanding how the structure was, understanding the pressure and the experience of people within the organization as well.
Sure. No, that's great. And something that I found actually really interesting, Camilla, is that, you know, you started your role literally just a few months before the onset of COVID. And then that was also quickly followed by obviously the unfortunate incidents with the George Floyd killing and the Black Lives Matter movement. So clearly there was a lot going on at the time when you started. And I wondered, how did Wavemaker respond to those events from a DEI perspective, and also what was your kind of like role, you know, within that?
Yeah, it was so interesting. I mean, what a time to an interesting time to be moving into that role. So if I take the two pieces separately, first of all, the COVID-19 response, I mean, it was obviously difficult for everybody going into lockdown and the isolation and all those things that came about. One interesting thing around kind of technology was that we had been trying as an organization to embed Teams into the business for about 2 years. And then within 2 or 3 weeks, everyone had adopted it and people were up to speed. And as a global business, it was interesting because it meant we were much more connected than ever before. Mm-hmm. And those international colleagues, you kind of were, it was a leveler and very, I think it was very good for the connectivity in that way. And it was a steep learning curve for all of us. I think there was a lot of kind of coming together around COVID-19, and we're part of WPP, which is our holding company, and they did a lot of events and activity as well around checking in with people's mental health and making sure people were looking after themselves. So those elements were all pretty good. And I think as well, our clients who are our number one priority, they were trying to understand and how to react as well. So everything accelerated. And actually, I think the Wavemaker workforce was working incredibly hard to try and understand how we needed to respond in terms of our clients. And in terms of the people, I think what was interesting is that with COVID, it accelerated the use of technology, but I think it also made visible the conversation around mental health that had never really been there before, and being more concerned and caring and prioritizing people's mental health. And I'm not saying that happened in every team in every country, but it definitely brought it to the forefront of the organization and the wider WPP group as well.
Cool. Excellent. Thank you for that. And I guess, you know, we've seen in the last couple of years more and more research, but also media coverage around diversity, equity, and inclusion. I guess in some ways, you know, those words have been sort of used to an extent interchangeably. And sometimes you hear people use them in different contexts. And so I guess, you know,
could you, Lloyd, really, I'm sorry, I lost you for a moment then. It just froze and then accelerated, and you said using the words.
Oh, okay, sorry about that. No, I was just basically saying, can you hear me now? Okay. Yeah, so I was just basically saying that in the last couple of years, obviously, there's been a lot of research, there's been a lot of media coverage about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And sometimes those sort of concepts have been used interchangeably, or they've been used in different ways, in different contexts, in different countries. And so the question really was for Maria, and that was just really kind of wanting to sort of get your perspectives on the concept of inclusion, and you know how that is currently sort of defined within the literature.
From the research perspective, I think, well, Camilla, you know, absolutely right. Of course, the differences from research perspective, we do know, tend to know much more about what these concepts mean or how they operate, our policy operates in the Western countries, because there's been a lot of research around it in the UK, US, and in Europe, although even in Europe, not so much in all of Europe, but in particular clusters of the European countries and, you know, Scandinavian countries and stuff. And so we really do know much less about these issues and how they play out in the countries of the Global South, for example. And indeed, I would imagine that some of the issues may be understood differently or resonate differently depending on sort of where they are. And I think it's probably a matter of understanding the context and understanding, well, what is relevant dimension of difference in that particular country. Maybe it's not race, maybe it is, I don't know, gender or class, and making these policies relevant to each all of the countries where, I suppose, the company operates. And
sure. And I guess kind of building on that point then, I mean, you know, it would obviously imply that, you know, an employee in an organization, for example, might have periods during their time working for that organization where they feel more included than not. And so there's kind of this ebb and flow, if you like, from what I'm hearing from you. Is that fair?
And this is a common pattern across cultures, you know, the glass ceiling and sort of the lack of women in top positions. So that's why we see that sort of shimmy across cultures and continents, and unfortunately.
Great. Thanks, Maria. So, Camilla, I'm also really intrigued to understand how DEI has been embedded within and across Wavemaker so far. You kind of touched upon a few points earlier, but I was wondering whether you could expand on that a bit more.
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, one of the things that obviously happened in 2020 was not just COVID, but also the George Floyd murder in the US and the kind of not emergence, but the strengthening of Black Lives Matter movement and the impact that that had. And I guess it was at a time when everyone's eyes were focused on the same thing as well. So it certainly wasn't the murder wasn't a unique event, but it did catch the attention of the world. And at that point, so I'd then just gone into the role of doing, of the global head of DE&I, and I had some consultants, and I was developing a strategy for a global strategy for DE&I. And the number one objective on that strategy was to raise the visibility of DE&I within the organization. Because of COVID, everything kind of moved online. And so it was good because we were doing it online and it was a really inclusive global group. But also it was a kind of new to us to kind of do everything online rather than in person. So we started off this process, and from kind of talking about with this kind of group of stakeholders and influencers, how to make DE&I more visible, from being in the shadows, suddenly the spotlight was glaring in our eyes, you know, and saying, "Oh, you've taken on this role. What are you doing about it? How are we going to now tackle DE&I as an organization?" And so, in terms of influencing the culture, I mean, what we were, so that I think worked as a huge acceleration to just raise DE&I as a topic. And what I'm really pleased to see is it hasn't gone away 2 years later. Mm-hmm. It's still an important priority for organizations. And WPP recently, we did a survey of global clients and asking like a few thousand global clients, what do they want from WPP and its agencies? collaboration or partnership on DE&I was around, I think it was in the top three. It was in the top three of responses of what they want from their agencies. So we see that it's important priority for the agencies and their clients. And what we did as a company was developed a global strategy that then could be adopted and adapted for the local markets. So that rather than what had previously happened is you had pockets of people who were passionate about DE&I driving activity, now there was an aligned approach to what we needed to do. So it was focusing on, you know, key markets and markets where it's important rather than just the markets where you had someone who was passionate and driving it in that way. And then that has evolved. So this time last year, we did some work with our global exco to look at what are they doing. Ultimately, you know, these 12 people, the most senior in the company, set the kind of agenda for the organization and are the key influencers. And each of them has made pledges of what they are going to do to drive an inclusive culture at Wavemaker. And those pledges are then tracked now on a scorecard and shared to see how well each of those are doing, with our global CEO kind of taking ownership and a great interest to see how everyone is doing. So it's, you know, DE&I isn't just the responsibility of the DE&I team, which at the moment is just me anyway. It's, you know, it's got to be something that leaders get behind as well to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. And I guess it kind of brings us on quite nicely to the next question, which is actually for both of you. And I really wanted to kind of understand, you know, based on the experiences you've had, how does the sort of understanding and interpretation of DEI differ across countries and continents? And I think maybe if we can just start with you, Camilla, given that you've just talked about local markets just briefly earlier.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So we've got a global network of DE&I champions who are around 100 people now from many different, you know, from all, not every market, but from most markets. And we spoke earlier about inclusion and belonging and what it means, and it has to be that at the heart, that it's so that people feel that they belong in the organization, that they're included and they can be their authentic selves. But what is very different in different markets is diversity. And diversity means different things, but I think belonging and inclusion can mean is much more aligned in what it means. For example, in Wavemaker for our APAC regions, the focus is a lot on mental health there. Mm-hmm. And mental and kind of well-being or well-working, and making sure that people are being looked after and working in a kind of productive and healthy way. But, you know, diversity in terms of ethnicity in some markets is relevant, but others it's really not. Like in China, the vast majority of our employees are all the same ethnicity, you know. So things like Black Lives Matter can become actually, you know, they're just not relevant for them in the same way and don't resonate and can make DE&I seem to not be relevant to them. But they're very keen on exploring the mental health aspects of things. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And I guess, you know, that there's always that risk that you kind of see DEI as this sort of broad sweeping concept, when actually there are multiple concepts within DEI that all have different meanings to different people and across different countries as well. But what I'm hearing from a sort of practitioner perspective is that actually, you know, you've got almost like a sort of centralized sort of, you know, DEI strategy, but equally at the same time, there needs to be some leeway and some scope for local markets to interpret those strategies as and how they see fit. Is that a fair
absolutely fair? I mean, I think it would be a paradox if we were to say from the UK for the rest of the world, this is the DEI strategy that you need to adopt. So what we have got is a kind of a strategic framework that can be rolled out and applied in different markets. And from the centre, we have, it's kind of to some extent a coordination and networking role of bringing together the best from our 7,000 employees and sharing that through our technological platforms so that programs can inspire, can be adopted, can be adapted for work in local markets rather than parallel pathing or reinventing the wheel. We want to make different programs that have been successful available. And also, because we have different markets with different needs, identifying programs that are going to help to deliver on inclusivity and belonging, and then piloting them in markets and rolling them out where there's a need.
Cool. Thanks for that. And Camilla, Maria. Are there any broad trends that you have identified with regards to how inclusive practices are being fostered within organisations from the research side of things?
Well, I can definitely say that what we find in our research with companies is exactly that COVID kind of exposed the fragility of some of the diversity and inclusion work that companies have done and how quickly that can be rolled back, or if it's left left to just individuals, it's a kind of, there are pros and cons, obviously. Of course, a line manager would know better what works for some teams and what doesn't work for others in the team. But at the same time, we do hear that, I was so lucky, and a friend of mine wasn't so lucky. And obviously that shows this disparity of experiences that people may have had. In terms of, I think your initial question, I think somehow focused on women and mothers. And I think for me, that's a different question. I think it's sort of less so about the great resignation and more so about the great, being forced out in some ways, because when the childcare provision is withdrawn, the fallback is on parents, and when we say parents, we often mean mothers, and that's what we've seen. And statistics does show it's a well-documented phenomenon that many women have lost their jobs or chose, in inverted commas, to step back because they just simply could not combine intensive work with managing childcare at home. And there are different underlying problems with that that cause that, and not necessarily organizational, but the fact that the UK has one of the most expensive and most ineffective childcare systems in most of Europe, unfortunately, which the childcare system that does not really talk to organizations where parents are employed so much. And that is an issue that continues to exist, unfortunately, and especially in conversations with both parents, but also organizations, it's the emergency childcare as well that is a problem. And that's perhaps in some cases we found that, I mean, one of the tangible ways of helping parents was through organizational means would be to have something like a childcare provision or availability or flexibility, or applying that, you know, a bit more flexibility to that. Sorry, that was a bit rambly. I apologize. And yeah, another thing is obviously the stereotypes. Yeah, how we see who's taking charge. Yeah, so if somebody has to step back, we know that it's usually the mother rather than the father. And sometimes line managers also more eagerly give that leeway to mothers and stigmatize fathers who want to be more involved. And we know that that is also a problem that kind of works its way into the system, that fathers, even if they want to be, taking more and kind of helping foster women's careers, they can also be stigmatized if they do that.
Great, thanks for that. And I guess again, it kind of sort of reinforces the point that, you know, you've both made earlier, just about this sort of, you know, dynamic kind of process and needing to have a sort of ongoing sort of strategy and initiatives actually to really sort of be able to see you know, the kind of change that well, you know, we all want to see. So yeah, that's great, and thank you for sharing those things. So I want to go back to Camilla now, and I'm really keen to understand, you know, your thoughts about the great resignation, which has been happening in recent years, not just in the media and comms industry, but also in many other sort of industries. And what's the role that DEI can play in terms of helping to, I guess, stem that tide of the great resignation that we've been seeing? And I know that's a really big question, because obviously there's lots of reasons why that has been happening. But, you know, within the context of today's discussion, if you're able to share any sort of thoughts on that, that would be really appreciated.
Absolutely.
I don't know who wants to take that first. You want to take that first?
Well, Maria, if that's both of us, I'm happy to hand over to you.
Yeah. Now go on, Camilla.
Okay. I think it's quite interesting, the Great Resignation, because already that's beginning to feel slightly dated, with a kind of recession around the corner. And I think there's more concern now, especially within marketing and communications, about, you know, making sure the workforce is okay, understanding what our budgets are going to be for the next couple of years if and when there is a recession. And I think the Great Resignation comes back to, you know, what has meant. I think COVID made people reassess their lives and their experiences and their approach and their relationship with work and relationship with family. I think that technology and hybrid working has meant that in many ways it's really great for a lot of people, especially marginalized groups, so carers who are able to spend more time caring and for themselves, but also with people with neurodiverse, people who are neurodivergent, you know, being able to have a home set up that really suits them rather than commuting and coming into an office where they may not feel as comfortable and be so productive. But I think there was also an element of, without culture and feeling that you're working for a group and being and in that kind of inclusive culture and belonging, I think that's where we began to lose people from the industry. And I think that, you know, Maria, you were just talking about the individual initiatives versus systemic ones. I mean, I think what's quite interesting and what comes to light is how even within one organization, people can have very different experiences depending on who their line manager is. And maybe that was amplified during the COVID times because most of their experience of the organization was funneled through line managers rather than having a wider influence when everyone is there in person. And I think as an organization, we are looking more towards what can we do with line managers to, it's fantastic we've got these programs in place for our leaders. It's fantastic that we've got our brilliant DE&I champions, but the line manager experience is such a critical one. And what do we do there around DE&I? So a roundabout way of answering your question, Lloyd, but I hope that makes sense.
No, it makes sense, definitely. And I think it's an interesting point because obviously you've highlighted just a few nuances there as well within the media and comms industry, just with regards to the outlook, you know, for the upcoming years and the impact that could potentially have as well. And Camilla, are you sort of seeing developments in terms of progress around that? If you take Wavemaker as an example, have you got sort of initiatives that you're kind of looking at or building on to help sort of deal with some of those issues?
Yeah, I'm really sorry. I have got a 3 o'clock, but okay. Briefly, I mean, I think what we've had in the UK recently, and I think if you mean relating to the parental issue that Maria was talking about, was that we've got a family ERG now, and they've done really good work on trying to kind of highlight the experience of parents and carers, and highlight and normalize. And normalize sounds such a strange word when we think of, you know, that we were all children at once, and then many of us are parents and carers, you know. But I think making it as a more visible part of people's lives. But I don't think it's easy, and I definitely don't think it's been cracked. But I'm very pleased to say, like, some of the people, senior leaders, I see more openly, you know, leaving to pick up children or fitting in childcare or general caring duties around work, and it being an accepted norm. I think it's changed an awful lot since I had children. My eldest child's 22 now, but it's certainly, I know, very challenging for a lot of parents still.
I just want to say huge thank you to Dr. Maria Adamson and Camilla Bruggen for their time today. Really great to hear your thoughts and perspectives from a research perspective and also from a practitioner perspective. So thank you so much, and we'll call it there.